Okay, so welcome back to the second part of the morning. I'm going to be talking about one of the suttas from Pali Canon, and I'm going to talk a little bit first about the Pali Canon, but only for a couple of minutes, so I won't bore you all, I promise, even though it probably is my favourite subject. If I was ever on Mastermind, it would be the Pali Canon. But I don't intend to ever go on Mastermind. The Pali Canon. So what is the Pali Canon? So it's a collection basically of Buddhist texts, some of which we're told were the actual word of the Buddha, and some of them aren't. Pali Canon broadly is split into three key sections. So there's what we call the Sutta section, so the word of the Buddha. There's the Vinaya section, which is the kind of ethical conduct section. And there's a big long word, Abhidhamma, which is kind of the explanation of the Buddha's teachings. So the canon is split into these three sections. The first section of the canon is what we call the Sutta Pitaka, or the basket of suttas. And there are around 10,000 suttas in the Pali Canon, a little bit more than that. No, I haven't read them all. I've read thousands of them, but not 10,000. So, and to me, suttas or sutras, you're more familiar with sutras. Sutta and sutra are not the same word. We always get them confused. So sutta comes from a root in Pali, which means something well said, whereas sutra, it comes from stitching or threading. So while the words sound the same and they're often used interchangeably, they don't actually have the same root in how we use them. We do use them interchangeably, but Pali canon, so in Pali, the word is sutta, so I'll be using the word sutta. In later Buddhist texts, you'll hear the word sutra. So ostensibly they're the same thing, but if you're a pedant like me with the language, then they're not. They're not the same. But suttas are the fundamental building blocks of the Buddha's teachings. They're the most direct source that we have of what the Buddha actually said and what the Buddha actually taught, and how they were written down hundreds of years after the Buddha had died, for us to still have access to 2,500 years later. So in this series of Saturday mornings, we kicked off last week with Dharmadipa looking at the Honeyball Sutta, and that looked at how conflict arises. But specifically on these mornings, we're looking at one part of the suttas, and that's the Majjhima Nikaya, which is all in one handy text here, Majjhima Nikaya. Majjhima literally means middle, Nikaya literally means collection, so literally in middle collection, although we usually say middle length collection, just so it's makes a bit more sense. The reason why it's Majjhima is because the suttas are generally fairly short. So this morning sutta fits on 2.5 pages, you know, it's quite a short one. If you go for some of the longer suttas, you can have like 50-60 page suttas. So there's a lot of what we call foundational teachings in the Majjhima Nikaya, really important suttas that are really express some of the fundamental Buddhist teachings. And there's 152 suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, so it's not a very big collection. If you go to some of the other collections, like the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical collection, there's 2,000 or 3,000 suttas in that one. So there's lots of different ways to get into suttas. And you may have heard of some of the well-known suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya, things like the Anapanasati, Satipatthana suttas, so more around meditation, Avyapariyasana Sutta, which is around the Buddha's noble search or noble quest. There's also lots of suttas in here which you may not have heard of, and I picked this morning's one because while it's a well-known teaching, it's not a sutta that's often discussed. So I'm going to be talking about the Ambalatika Rahulavada Sutta, which just trips off the tongue, obviously. I'll explain more about that in a minute, but it's like I mentioned, it's a very short sutta, but it's also very powerful. And it says a lot in just a couple of pages. And when I first came across this 10 years ago, when I first started coming along to the centre, it was one of the early teachings that just really leapt off the page at me, and it continues to do so when I was reading it again last night. It's just a sutta that it just seems to be more and more profound. There's more and more depth to it each time you read it. I think as our understanding grows, we can understand these suttas in a different way and see more of what the Buddha was saying again and again. There's something about its direct simplicity for me, but also its depth and the way it expresses a truth. And one of the other things that I really like about this sutta, so has anyone heard of King Ashoka or the Ashokan pillars? So King Ashoka was a king in India in around the 3rd century BC. And he was a Buddhist practitioner, and he had installed, so we're told, tens and tens of pillars around India, which were inscribed with Buddhist teachings. And there's still somewhere around 15 or 20 of these pillars still standing in India today. And on one of those pillars, part of this sutta is actually written on one of the remaining pillars. Sorry? I don't know which one it is, I'd have to look it up. But I think there's 15 or 19 left, and on one of those there's sort of partial inscription of this sutta. So it kind of makes it more alive for me as well, thinking that actually, you know, this was inscribed in the 3rd or 2nd century BC, and yet those words are still there, inscribed, etched in stone for everyone to learn from. I think that's a lovely thing to contemplate. So unlike last week's sutta, so the honey bull sutta, as Dharmadipa pointed out, the title doesn't bear any relation to what the sutta was about. Whereas this week's sutta also doesn't really bear, the title doesn't bear any relation to what the sutta is about. So I'll explain what sutta means. So, and Bharatika is literally a mango plant or mango grove, literally. But it's also, so we're told in the commentary, it's also a place, there's a town called Rajagaha in ancient India, where lots of Buddhist activities took place in the Buddha's time, and we're told that Bharatika was the name of a place near Rajagaha, but it literally means mango grove. And the second part of the title, Rahula, well, that was the name of the Buddha's son. But it's interesting, when you look into that name, so the actual word Rahu was derived from an ancient Indian dragon or demon, and that demon was said to swallow up the sun and the moon. So Rahu was considered to be an obstructive force that blocks the light of the sun and the moon. So Rahula was derived from Rahu, the offspring of Rahu, literally, would mean. And it came to mean a sort of fetter or a bind, something that holds you back. So not a very good name, perhaps, to give your child. So the second part of the title, Rahula, is Rahula. And the last bit, Ovada, is a Pali word which means literally advice. So the literal translation of Mbalatika Rahula Vada would be advice to Rahula in the mango grove. It doesn't tell you what the sutta is about at all, but it is saying to you, it is the Buddha giving advice to his son. And there's some funny bits in the commentary saying he was doing this after Rahula had been knocking around and doing some bad stuff. I'll come on to that a bit later. And this sutta includes directly or indirectly topics such as ethics, karma. It looks at our mental states. It looks at our ability to reflect, how we reflect, why we reflect, and consider what we do. It looks at how we, in an ideal sense, would reflect before we do something, while we're doing it, and after we've done it. It also touches on right view and the need for truthfulness and mindfulness at all times. And it also emphasises the importance of refraining from intentional false speech. So there's a lot packed into these two and a half page sutta, as I mentioned earlier. And this discourse apparently took place when Rahula, when the Buddha's son, was 11 years old, although some commentary texts say he was only 7. I would go more with the 11, because there's a couple of examples in the Pali Canon of when the Buddha went back to his family home when Rahula was 7, and his son saw him for the first time. Rahula saw the Buddha for the first time as he approached. In the sun, all he could see was literally just a shadow. And Rahula, as a 7-year-old, even said, "Even the aesthetic shadow is pleasing to me." So there was something about just seeing the Buddha's shadow in the eyes of this 7-year-old that was pleasing to him. So when the Buddha first visited his family home, I find that very powerful that Rahula would say that at a tender age of 7 years old. But what we're going to do is talk about this sutra in a bit of a different way. So I've had three crazy volunteers this morning, and what we're going to do is actually read some of the sutta to you, but in the forms of a little play. So I split it into three sections. So we're going to do section one now. So we've got Jane, we've got Inga and Graham, who have kindly volunteered to read some of this to you. So far away.
It was evening time. The Buddha rose from meditation and went to see Rahula. On seeing the Buddha approaching, Rahula set out a seat, as was traditional, some water in a bowl for the Buddha to wash his feet. The Buddha washed his feet and deliberately left a little bit of water in the bowl and said to Rahula,
"Do you see this little bit of water left in the bowl?"
"Yes, venerable sir."
"Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, there is as little good in them as this."
The Buddha then threw away the remaining water and asked Rahula,
"Rahula, did you see the small amount of water I threw away?"
"Yes, venerable sir."
"Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, the good there is in them is thrown away like this."
The Buddha then turned the bowl upside down and asked,
"Rahula, do you see this water bowl turned upside down?"
"Yes, venerable sir."
"Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, the good there is in them is treated like this. It's turned upside down."
The Buddha then turned the bowl the right way up and asked,
"Rahula, do you see this bowl now the right way up and quite empty?"
"Yes, venerable sir."
"Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, they are quite as empty of good as this."
So we didn't have the same much, did he? So that's a very profound teaching that the Buddha gave to his son. You know, in the first section where the Buddha said, you know, he left the small bit of water in the bowl and said, "Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, there is as little good in them as this." And to me, that's the Buddha talking. It represents the lack of consideration and wisdom in a person who lies without shame. And that's one of the key things in the text and in the Pali, is without shame. And there's lying, and there's just lying shamelessly, blatantly. Why is lying so bad? We're talking about here, talking about deliberate lies. And you know you're doing it purposely. It's a deliberate act of lying. And it also reveals our intention and motivation as well. What are we trying to get out of what we're saying? Why are we lying? For example, if we're truly motivated by compassion, there may be instances when lying is not as bad as if we're lying with an intention based on greed, hatred or delusion. So there's always different circumstances. It's quite an annoyance thing. But if you're lying intentionally and that intention is based on delusion or anger, then you're in trouble. And if there's no sense of shame, or you're not even conscious that you're telling lies, then you're really stuck. You're really in trouble. So that's the kind of first bit of what the Buddha was saying there. And then when the Buddha threw the water away and said, "Unless people are careful to avoid knowingly telling lies, the good there is in them is thrown away like this." That's a very powerful metaphor, isn't it? It's just saying, it's just thrown away like that. And one of the ways that's commented on in the commentary on the Pali Canon is it's around, you know, a spiritual person, a holy person, if they lie intentionally, the good in them is just thrown away instantly, just like clicking your fingers. If you're lying shamelessly, intentionally, that's it. The third bit is perhaps more obvious when you turn the bowl upside down. And basically, that's the Buddha saying, you know, if you tell lies intentionally, you will turn your life upside down. This is where the teaching of karma will come into effect as well. And if you lie intentionally, there will be consequences to you doing that, isn't it? You will be found out in the end. And when the Buddha turned the bowl of the lottery up again and said to Rahula, "Do you see that bowl? It's now empty. It's quite empty." What the Buddha was saying there is that, you know, if you continue to tell intentional lies, you will make your spiritual life empty and void. So your life will become empty. You will become hollow, shallow. There will be no content if you just live your life intentionally lying and shamelessly lying again and again and again. So it's a very short introduction to the sutta, but those four examples that the Buddha gave are very, very powerful. Very powerful indeed, about if you lie, there will be consequences, and you will start backsliding from any progress that you've made on your spiritual path. You will start to undo the good work that you have done if you shamelessly lie over and over again. So after giving that teaching, the Buddha then went on to tell Rahula about a royal tusker, or a royal battle elephant, with tusks as long as chariot poles, we're told in the sutta. And in this story, the elephant, although used to being in battle and using its feet, its ears, its flanks, its tusks and its tail, does not use its trunk. And as the Buddha tells the story, he says that the rider of the elephant notices this and thinks, the elephant is using all of its limbs, but he keeps his trunk back. And the rider interprets this as the elephant has not yet fully devoted its life to the king, because it's holding something back. But as soon as the elephant then goes into battle and uses all of his limbs and his trunk as well, the rider also notices that and says, the elephant has now devoted his life to the king. He needs no more training. So we're going to have a very short act two. This is, I think Rahula gets a rest in act two.
After the Buddha had told the parable of the royal battle elephant, he said,
"So too, Rahula, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I say, that one would not do. So, Rahula, you must train yourself never to speak a falsehood, even as a joke."
So again, the Buddha's being very direct. You know. So, if you tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil that you would not do. That's pretty direct, isn't it? You can't really misinterpret that at all. In a way, it's a bit of a strange simile, isn't it? Talking about a royal battle elephant. But I think the underlying message there is the Buddha was saying that we need to continually train ourselves. We need to devote our energy to the practice of purifying our speech until open, honest, truthful speech becomes natural all the time, until it becomes all-pervasive, until we no longer need to consciously train it. It becomes part of who we are. Our speech is purified. I think that's what he's saying. What he's not saying, even as a joke, what the Buddha's not saying is you can't tell jokes. Because jokes are funny. Dandajaya told me a couple of crackers the other weekend, which I won't repeat here. But so jokes are fine, but what the Buddha is saying is don't tell a lie and make that lie into a joke. Because quite often we do that, perhaps, don't we? You know, we tell what we may think is a small lie, but we try and turn it into a joke so we can let ourselves off the hook and make it not seem as bad that we've lied. You know, we try and give ourselves permission to lie by turning it into a joke. And the Buddha was saying, don't do that. Also important to remember here that the Buddha was giving this teaching to an 11-year-old boy. So he has to use concrete similes. He has to use examples that will make the ethical messages very vivid and real for this 11-year-old boy, his son. And I think he does this brilliantly, especially in the next part of the teaching, where he develops the theme further. So we'll leap right on into Act 3. where all three of our actors were there participating.
The Buddha then said,
"What do you think a mirror is for, Rahula?"
"For reflection, to look at oneself in."
"So too, Rahula, an action with the body, an action by speech, or an action by mind should be done only after repeated reflection."
"What do you think a mirror is for reflection?" Brilliant, isn't it? So simple, you know, but he gave that to an 11-year-old boy, and yet to me, as a lot more than 11 years old, you know, it still just speaks out in its simplicity, but in its directness. You know, and the Buddha was saying, reflect. And the next bit of the sutta goes into this in more detail, so we're not just now looking at speech. We're taking this further, and the Buddha is saying in this beautiful simile, you know, he's saying, just as a mirror is always reflective, so too should we always be mindful, always be aware of the potential wholesome or unwholesome effect inherent in every thought, word and deed. So we've gone beyond just talking about speech now, we're looking at body, speech and mind, looking at our thoughts, looking at our words and in the actions and deeds that we undertake. And the Buddha distinguishes in this next bit of the sutta three distinct phases with regards to any action. So before the action, while you're engaged in the action, and after completing the action. And you can kind of look at that in a sense of looking at the future, the present and the past. What's going to happen in the future if you do this action? What's going to happen right now if you do this action? And what's the effect going to be once you've done this action? So the Buddha is really saying that before we do anything, any action with body, speech or mind, one should reflect if the action will lead to one's own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both. That's the words that he used in the text. So before we do anything with body, speech or mind, is it going to lead to the affliction of ourselves, the affliction of others, or to the affliction of ourselves and others? And that's highlighting the need to be concerned with the spiritual welfare, both of others and of ourselves. And one way you could look into this a lot further, which we won't have time for this morning, is which made me laugh when I thought of this last night, is actually think before you think. Yeah, that's what the Buddha's saying here. Think before you think. You know? And there's actually a whole sutta, if you go into the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and so looking at that, part of that practice is turn your mind on your mind. Think before you think. There's a whole practice that the Buddha outlines how you do that. Very, very useful. And it's a natural extension of, you know, mindfulness of breathing in many ways is just the kind of introduction practice. If you then go in and look at the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which are body, speech, mind and phenomena, then you can start to examine what's going on in a lot more detail. You really start to get a view of the range and the depth of your consciousness when you start to look at it in such a way. You know, think before you think. You know, and you can investigate that in the Satipatthana. Maybe we can look at that another time. What will be the impact of the action on yourself and on others? Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? What is the quality of your mind that is responsible for the action? And that's where thinking before you think comes into it. If you know you're in a distressed or aggravated mental state, the quality of your mind is perhaps not going to be as wholesome as you'd like it to be. And that will have a direct effect on any actions that you're undertaking, be it actions of body, speech or mind. So looking at the quality of a mind, looking at the quality of your mind is absolutely essential, because it directly affects the action that you're undertaking. Ask yourself, what are the karmic consequences going to be? If you do this action, what are the likely consequences going to be? It comes back to that basic teaching on karma, the bit sometimes people forget. The intention comes before the action. Before you do anything, you have an intention to do it. Before I pick up my tablet to read my notes, I have to intend to pick it up. Before I drink my cup of tea, I have to intend to pick it up. Intention will always come before the action. before you do something, what are the karmic consequences going to be? Are they going to be painful consequences? Are they going to be pleasant consequences? Is it going to be relatively neutral? But what are the likely consequences of the action? You don't always know, but you can generally get a pretty good feel for it. So look at the psychological state that the action is arising from. You know, when you're distressed, when you're stressed, when you're angry, when you're upset, the psychological state is going to be different. You're going to be approaching life in a different way. You're going to be veiled in your approach because you're not going to be open. So always come back to looking at the likely consequences of the action. That's hard, isn't it? Because that requires a fair amount of insight. It requires you to be fairly self-aware of how you are in the world, how you live your life, how you interact with the people at work or at home. Now, I catch myself sometimes interacting with my daughters. I've got two teenage daughters. That's challenging. And who are meeting after the class to, "Dad, we want to spend some money." And I don't want to spend money, but "Dad, we need these things." And I find myself, "Yes, but..." You know, trying to teach them the value of money. And, "Dad, it's only money. You go to work to earn money." Yeah, not quite that simple, as we all know. But, it does... I have to keep on checking into my psychological states and saying, "Okay, I can just keep teaching them over and over again. I just want to record it and say, 'Just play this one today.'" But if only it was that simple. But actions are powerful. Our actions can set off chain reactions if we're not careful. You know, I work for the police, and I see some very skillful behaviour and I see some very unskillful behaviour. And I've seen some, well, this week I've seen some chain reactions go off where someone has said something, and this mushroom cloud has spread across a certain part of the organisation, and a bunch of people have gotten to a real grump about it. And I went in there and just said, "Just because he said that doesn't need to affect you. That's on him. That's not yours to own. Just ignore that. Just do this instead." Yeah, okay, it helps that I outrank the person that said all this stuff, but nevertheless, our actions can go a lot further than we can contemplate sometimes. We don't always know what the impact is going to be of what we say or what we do. Then it comes back. Was it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? What's the motivation? Is it motivated by greed, aversion, resentment, desire for revenge, conceit, pride, jealousy? What's the motivation behind it? Or was our action motivated by mental factors like kindness, generosity? There's another essential part of Buddhism here that's really necessary to know. What are the answers to those questions I ask? Right view is needed. You know, we need right view. First bit of the Noble Eightfold Path. We need right view to know or have more of an idea, an inkling of what's the likely cause of this action. Is it wholesome or is it unwholesome? If we have wrong view, then we can kind of see where the action's going to go. It's probably going to be more down the unwholesome route because our views are tainted in such a way. So right view is needed to have a better understanding of the law of karma and its results. So that was just talking about before we do something, you know, so it's pretty stacked here, isn't it? It's pretty saying, before you do something, do all this that the Buddha talked about, you know, reflect before you do anything. But in the same way, the Buddha also says, before we're going to take an action, reflect, we should also do that while we're engaged in the action. So while we're doing something, be conscious of what we're doing. Don't do anything on autopilot. Reflect upon it, and if you know it's unwholesome, and generally you will know if what you're doing is unskillful or unwholesome, generally, if it brings pain and bad consequences, then if possible you should stop the action immediately. That might mean going beyond your pride. You know, you might be doing something out of a sense of pride. Deep down you know it's wrong, and if you know it's wrong and it's unskillful and unwholesome, stop it. Don't do it. That's what the Buddha's saying in this second bit. Before you do it, reflect. While you're doing it, reflect. Probably the hardest thing of all, because we're caught up in the doing of whatever the action is, whether it's something we're saying, something we're doing. Actions are body, speech and mind. And that applies, you know, speech also applies, just to remind you, to this horrible thing called email. You know, probably most people in this room have been wound up by one email or two in their life, or 50 a week, or 100 a week, or whatever. You know, email's a very blunt medium. Some people are not very good at expressing themselves via that medium. And we probably all sat there, got an email, and felt ourselves getting stressed and angry, feeling the blood pressure going up because of an email. You know, that's you having a response to what someone has put. But so speech isn't just me talking to you, you talking to me, us speaking. It is about what you write. Even text messaging. You know, I've had text messages and I think, what the dickens is that about? Catch your breath and don't reply back in cold. If only it was that easy. But and that's what the Buddha was saying here, is while you're doing something, reflect on it. Take the opportunity to say, actually, if this is not going to be right, don't press send. Do something different. You know, delete. Use the backspace key. Put the phone down. Walk away from the computer. Reflect on it. And again, you know, the same applies. If it brings benefit, and it comes from a wholesome state of mind, and it has pleasant consequences, continue with the action. Like I said, there's an element of this of going beyond our pride. You know, we take pride a lot of time in what we're doing and how we're doing things, especially in a work environment. Sometimes we do just have to say, actually, I was wrong. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to behave in that way anymore. I'm not going to continue doing that thing because it was wrong. So the third part of this last section is the Buddha saying, so we've talked about reflecting before you do something. We've just talked about reflecting while you're doing something. And there's also after the action has completed, after you've finished doing something, reflect upon it. And if you realise it's unwholesome, that it's brought painful results, it's arisen from unwholesome mental factors, it's caused distress to someone else, then what the text says, what the Buddha says, is that we should confess it. We should reveal it. It uses the words, we should lay it open, which I think is really powerful. So if we reflect on something after we've done it and we think, yeah, that was wrong, I just should not have done that, lay it open, maybe to others and yourself. If you're able to confess it to others, then that's very powerful, but also very difficult sometimes. But it helps. It really helps. And also there's a part of this, of course, of maintaining restraint in the future. So don't do it again. Don't keep doing the same things over and over again, expecting a different result. That's the definition of madness, isn't it? Maintain restraint in the future. If you've done something, you think, oh, that was bad, I should not have done that. At least you've reflected on it, you've clocked it. Hopefully next time round you won't repeat it. What the text also says, though, that if it was wholesome, then live happily. Live in rapture, uses the word piti. Live with gladness, delight and joy, pamudya. So if you've done something that's good, be happy about it. You know, rejoice in it, celebrate it. If you know it was wholesome and beneficial, carry on doing it. And try to carry on training in those wholesome mental states. So that section of the sutta is taking morality very, very seriously. Before we do something, while we do it, after we've done it. And it's also about being brave enough to confess when we mess up. Not trying to hide it under the carpet, not trying to pretend it didn't happen, not trying to put the blame on someone else. It's just saying, I messed up. So there's a lot there to reflect upon. And the sutta ends with the Buddha stating that any ascetics or Brahmins in the past have purified their bodily, mental and verbal actions in this way. All ascetics and Brahmins in the future shall purify their actions in this way too. And all ascetics and Brahmins in the present purify their actions by repeatedly reflecting in this way too. So there's a very strong message right there in the ending paragraph of the sutta. You know, to make progress, then you need to reflect in this way, as the Buddha has outlined, before, during and after. Actions of body, speech and mind. Very strong message. Sets a very high standard of behaviour for us to aspire to, for sure. You know, it's not something perhaps that we can, I'm going to do that and I'll start at 2 o'clock this afternoon. We're going to have to learn and fail and learn and fail and learn and fail and keep on going, because it is hard, it's a difficult thing to do. But the Buddha is saying that if we want to make spiritual progress, we need to, indeed we have no choice but to reflect in this way. So summing up, the Buddha suggests that we employ these three criteria as a standard for reflection on how we should act, to determine whether to undertake or refrain from the action. And by doing so, we're able to consider the ethical dimension of the action, something we often overlook, the impact of it upon ourselves and others, and to look into the quality of mind, as I mentioned earlier, that is responsible for the action. What was the quality of mind that that action sprung from? We also get the opportunity, if we reflect in this way, to consider the karmic consequence of the action on ourselves and on others. Simply put, actions motivated by unwholesome mental states will generate unwholesome karma. It's pretty simple. And we also come to see that words particularly are a really good indicator of our mental states. And the problem is often not the mood. We can get in a mood a lot of the time. I do a lot of driving in my job. And I've sat for hours on the M25 last month. And you get in a mood with traffic and roadworks and traffic, and the same song seems to be on every channel on the radio when you go channel surfing, and then the phone rings and you're stuck having a conference call in the car and you've moved 100 yards. So where are you? Oh, I'm still on junction 9 of the M25. An hour later, I'm at junction 8 of the M25. So words are a really good indicator, and the problem is not the mood, it's how we identify with the mood. I'm in a mood because I'm upset because I'm in traffic. I'm in a mood because my children have annoyed me. I'm in a mood because someone shouted me at work. And we identify with the mood. The moods aren't a problem. The moods, like everything else, are impermanent. They will go. But the minute we identify with it, it's going to hang around longer. And the more we tell ourselves these stories about our mood, the more we create this narrative. Well, narrative inhibits change. Because we're identifying more and more with that particular mental state. The story is starting to go bigger and bigger, and the narrative is becoming more and more interesting in a sense, and then we're not going to change it because this is getting really interesting now. I'm really enjoying this stuck in traffic, seeing that bloke giving me the two fingers for cutting up, and you start, you know, propantarising. We talked a bit about this last week, a big part of the honeyball system. So the more stories we tell ourselves of our moods, the longer it will hang around, the less chance we give ourselves to take alternative action, because we're too caught up in that narrative. And that's where this sutta is emphasising, perhaps implicitly, that the importance of mindfulness. You know, mindfulness gives us the opportunity to change our behaviour. And these acts of reflection on acts of body, speech and mind before, during and after, we need to be mindful. That's where meditation helps train us to be more mindful. And we be more mindful of an action such as breathing, we can be more mindful of our mental states, be more mindful of our psychological states from day to day. So by following the advice of the Buddha in this sutta, it does help us to purify the mind. We can be more mindful of the implications of all thoughts, words and actions. In fact, we can transform our thoughts. Think before you think. Change the pattern of your thinking. When we change a pattern of our thinking, we can change a pattern of our lives. It plays out on a much bigger scale. So that was the Ambalatika Rahulavala Sutta, the Buddha's advice to Rahula in the mango grove. Thank you to our narrator, to the Buddha and to Rahula, for helping us just hear the story in a bit of a different way, a bit more of a direct way.